Welcome to the Digital Story Show, new tools for the creative mind. The Digital Story Show takes you inside with tips for creative pursuit of photography, music, video, hardware, software, techniques, and hacks. You'll soon find yourself thinking less about buttons and menus and more about expressing the artist that's inside of all of us. Now, the Digital Story Show with Derek Story.
Tuesday, November 1st, 2005, the Digital Story Show. Okay, well, today I'm going to talk about raw workflow. Last show, as you know, we tackled a little bit about why you would even want to mess with this file format, as opposed to the very simple and easy to work with JPEG format that's standard on all cameras. RAW, however, isn't standard on all cameras. It's a specialized format, a lot of times tuned to the very electronics and image sensor of the camera itself, and therefore no two RAW files generally are the same. And what I mean by that, a Nikon produces a different type of RAW file than a Canon, than an Olympus, and on and on and on and on. Okay, so we sort of wrestled with why you would even want to mess with these darn things in the last show, and now you've probably made up your mind to either give them a shot, or at least you may already be working with RAW files now, and may be looking for a few tips on what to do with them, how to manage them, how to make your whole workflow a lot easier, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. Now, I'm in really an interesting place to tackle this subject. Those of you that stop by the site, thedigitalstory.com, know that I've been posting a lot of nature pictures in the last week, and partly that's because I haven't been in the office, I haven't been in the studio, I haven't been anywhere near people for the most part. I've been hanging out up on the northern reaches of the California coastline, camping in my 1990 Vanagon. By the way, just as a side note, I actually made a movie about camping in a 1990 Vanagon in the wilds, and getting it together. I'll be editing over the next week or so. It's not as bad as you may think, just listening to me describe it here. It's actually kind of fun, and I have some real adventure with the movie also, because I managed to get myself stuck on the side of a mountain and a few other goodies, and actually taped the very rescue. But I don't want to get too much into that now. That's definitely a digression. But anyway, I've been out shooting for the last week. I was very lucky, even though there was a lot of rain. I managed to capture just a beautiful tule elk. I saw him originally in a meadow, not too far from one of my campsites. 14 points, the biggest rack I've ever seen that close before. He was very tolerant buck. He actually let me photograph him for a while he was eating. He kept an eye on me the whole time. And then, of course, when he got tired, he turned and faced me and lowered his head, and I knew that the interview was over. But anyway, before that happened, I got some pretty good shots. It's interesting, by the way, another much shorter digression. Is, you know, I'm standing there with a monopod, right? And I'm looking at this elk that when he raises, I'm a tall person. I'm 6'7". I'm really much taller than average. So I'm standing there with my camera, and I have a Bogan monopod that's pretty hefty, right? So when this buck turns around and faces me and lowers his head a little bit, I'm like an idiot. Instead of, you know, like saying, I'm going to leave right now, I'm standing there thinking, what if I took my monopod and I turned it sideways so that it's horizontal? And if he did charge me, maybe I could put it like right there at the top part of his rack, you know, and keep from getting gored. Stupid. Anyway, he didn't. he was just letting me know that he was getting tired of me. I mean, nobody likes to have somebody watch them while they eat, and I would imagine that he's no different than anyone else that way. But anyway, so enough of that. So I got the Tule Elk, some really nice shots of him. I posted one of them already on the digital story. And I captured a blue heron, which I've photographed blue heron many times before, but I've never really been satisfied with the total shot. And as you know, anyone knows that's ever tried to shoot these great blues, that they're very shy birds. They don't let you get very close at all. And they don't let you even maneuver so that you can kind of, you know, get yourself positioned so that you have a decent background. The minute they spot you and you start to do any movement at all, they're gone. And that's been the case for me in the past, even though I do have some decent shots. But this time I was really lucky, and this guy was sitting on a log that ran across a creek that had a dark background. It was in shadow, but he was being illuminated by the light. Really great situation. And he was somewhat patient. He didn't let me get very close. I know about, you know, how far they'll let you approach, and rarely closer than 100 yards. So, but I had a long lens, and I had image stabilizer on it, and there was enough light, and I did spot metering. And I actually got what I consider a pretty decent shot, probably my favorite of a blue heron that I've ever captured. And I posted that on the site also on the digital story. So if you want to see some of the stuff I've been up to for the last week, I'm trying to put a few shots up to share. And what's germane to this conversation today is that I shot everything in raw format all week. I was very disciplined, even though there were moments when I just wanted to shoot JPEG so I could, you know, play with them immediately. I was using both a Canon Rebel XT, and I like using that when I need telephoto shots because, you know, it has a lens magnification of 1.6, and so it extends my 300 millimeter lens to much longer, and I like that, even though it's 8 megapixels, you know, as opposed to the 12 megapixel Canon 5D, which I also shot with, and that has a what we call full frame image sensor, which I've talked a little bit about in the past. So I shot with both of those. They both generate .cr2 files. That's Canon's version of RAW for these two cameras. Even Canon doesn't even have one version of RAW. They have .crws for the older models too. So, I mean, you know, they don't even stick to one format, you know, within their own line of cameras. And these things, I took my PowerBook with me, and so these files were piling up on my PowerBook over the course of the week. And when it rained, I would plug the PowerBook into the inverter that I had in the van, which allowed me to run it without running down my van battery too much. It allows me to charge the PowerBook battery. And I would look at these things. But because I don't really have a great RAW workflow right now, I mean, I've played with Capture One software, and I think it's pretty good. And I have Adobe Photoshop and with Bridge, the latest version, and it's pretty decent. And I also have the Canon software, the latest version of its Digital Photo Professional. And I actually ended up using that more than the other software, in part because it generated thumbnails so quickly. And so I just want to talk just a few minutes about why that's important and some of the things that make RAW workflow a challenge, and then maybe some ideas around how to work around them. All right, well, let's just start with being able to look at the pictures themselves. The thumbnail, I mean, that's the first thing you want to do. That's why we shoot digital photography instead of film, is because we want to go back to our laptop or to our desktop computer and see what we've done, okay? Now, with some RAW files from older cameras, you can load them up into iPhoto and look at them right away. Unfortunately, iPhoto can't handle these two cameras that I have right now, although I'm sure it will soon enough with an update. So my workflow got messed up a little bit because when I was shooting with a Canon 10D, I could view my images right away in iPhoto, and that was actually kind of cool, but no more, at least not for the moment. So what I do is I organize them on the hard drive by folder. So they're kind of in chronological order, and I know, you know, which day I shot what and so on and so forth. And then I've been browsing the thumbnails because that's the first thing I want to do is just look at them themselves. And right now what I'm doing is I'm using the software that came with the camera. And this, in this case of the Canon, it's a digital photo professional with Nikon, Olympus. They all have their own versions. And the reason why I'm doing that is because it generates the thumbnails so quickly, right away. I tried using Adobe Bridge. I've tried using it a number of times. And I just think it generates the thumbnails too slowly. I have to wait too long even to see them. And for me, I just don't have enough patience for that. So I can at least browse the thumbnails with the software that came with the camera. Look at what I have. I can also look at the metadata. And that's one of the things I will say about the software that usually comes with the cameras is that they're often the best at giving you the most metadata shooting information than maybe a lot of the third-party software. And what I mean by that, things like aperture, exposure, what program mode you had it set in, if any, what metering pattern you used, you know, time, date, you know, on and on and on, even to the point that the lens that you had on there and at what focal length you had the lens set. And this is all very valuable information when you're reviewing your shots and trying to figure out, you know, why it was successful or why it wasn't successful. Having all this metadata handy really helps, you know, figure that out. So that's another thing I will say that I like about the software that comes with the cameras is that they help you figure out, you know, the metadata and look at the metadata easily, more easily sometimes than the third-party stuff. Okay, but then after browsing the thumbnails and sort of figuring out what I liked and what I didn't like, then the party really begins to dwindle down for me with that software. Because even the Canon software is great, and I've used the Nikon Olympus software also for looking at the images, not so great for adjusting them. I don't care for that very much. The controls to me are very clunky. So at this point, what I do then literally is that I go back to those original, I note what the file number is on them, and I open those files in Adobe Photoshop, okay, the latest version, which by virtue opens Camera Raw, which is the plugin application that comes with Adobe Photoshop that allows you to work with RAW files from all sorts of different cameras. Now, in the Canon software, I can launch the file in Photoshop directly from the software, or I can just go back to the file and drag it onto Photoshop icon, however you want to do it. You know, that just depends on your style. But I do like editing the pictures better in Camera Raw than I do almost any other piece of software I've used so far. Now, as you know, I'm looking forward to Aperture coming out, which is the new application from Apple, the new pro-level application that's really designed for RAW workflow and is going to make a lot of what I'm talking about right now, for me anyway, kind of passe. But for a lot of you, you're not going to want to shell out $499 for Aperture right off the bat, or you're not on a platform that can run it, so this conversation will still have some value for you. So anyway, open the file in Camera Raw, and there's where I edit it. And what you're doing at this point, when you open up a RAW file in the image editor, is that you're really assigning values to the data that's there. In other words, if you don't like, for instance, the white balance setting that you used when you shot it, I keep everything in auto white balance when I'm shooting RAW because I can assign, you know, different cloudy or daylight or whatever later on, and there's no penalty. So, and a lot of times auto actually works quite well. So in Camera Raw, I play with the white balance to make sure I have a setting that I like. And I make a few exposure adjustments using the exposure slider, sometimes the brightness slider, and sometimes the saturation too is a good point. I like to bump up the saturation a little bit. I tend to shoot, you know, my images in the camera so they're not oversaturated there. I'd rather make that decision later on, and often I do, especially on cloudy days, I'll decide to bump up that saturation a little bit. And pretty much just play with the sliders there in Camera Raw to get the image the way that I want. Now, if you have the latest version of Camera Raw that comes with the latest version of Photoshop, you can check those boxes. It has boxes with each slider that has an auto setting. And so that when you open the RAW file in Camera Raw, Camera Raw does its best take on adjusting it for you, and it does amazingly well. The auto adjustments in this latest version of Camera Raw, which I believe is 3.2, does a fantastic job of really getting you to a good starting point. Now, a lot of times I'll override one or two of the sliders a little bit, especially the exposure slider. But I do like that as a starting point. And for a lot of folks, that will get you out of Dodge right there. However you go about making your adjustments in Camera Raw or whatever software you're using, at that point, you still have to save the file to another format. In other words, you can't save those adjustments that you made back to that original RAW file that you photographed, that you captured. Now, I actually think that's a good thing because I don't want to overwrite that original data that I captured. I like having that original data left alone because that allows me to go back later on and reinterpret it, maybe for another use. So I think that's actually a good feature of the RAW format. But you do have to save these adjustments that you made to some file format, and then you can do all sorts of stuff with it. Now, my files always come in at 16-bit, okay? Remember, as I talked about last week, JPEGs are 8-bit, but RAW often allows you to shoot at 12 or 16-bit, and that's very handy, and that gives you just more photographic data to deal with in your shot. So you have, you know, more detail in shadows and highlights, and you have better graduation of tone and all that sort of stuff. Okay, so I stay in 16-bit for as long as I can when I'm working with these these images that, especially that I want to show a lot of detail, nature images, landscape, things like that. So I'm going to stay working with 16-bit, and I'm going to save the file as a Photoshop file. I like doing that because, as opposed to a JPEG, because everything that I do is still saved. So all my editing is not destructive at this point. I can change my mind, and it doesn't affect the image adversely. So you take all those adjustments that you've made to the RAW file, and you do a save, and Photoshop then puts all that information together for you and builds you a Photoshop file, if that's what you choose. And then you can save it to your hard drive. Now you have something that's a little bit more portable, because almost any serious image editor can read Photoshop files. By the way, you also have the option of saving it as a TIFF, which also preserves the image quality. There's no compression, unless you choose to use it with a TIFF. There's no compression. JPEG is the only one that's what we call a destructive file format here. And that's only when it compresses and recompresses the file. Now, I guess at some point I should always talk about, what's going on there with a JPEG. I don't think I'm going to do that right now, but I will say this, that JPEGs only lose information, only lose, that visual data when you edit them and then save them. if you open a JPEG, just look at it and make a print, put it in a slideshow or whatever, and then close it without editing, there's no image loss because there's no recompression. JPEGs only lose image quality when they have to recompress the data. And that the way that typically happens is if you make some sort of edit. So if you're worried about opening and closing your JPEGs that you do have, and that they're going to, over time, lose image quality, they're not going to unless you actually perform edits. And you can even get around that by making a copy of the file before you edit it and keeping your original JPEG pristine. So I'll leave it at that for now, and we can talk about more of those and more about that in future shows. But if you work in the TIFF or Photoshop format, you can even make edits, and you still don't have to worry about image loss. So now I have a 16-bit Photoshop file, pretty high quality, pretty big file, right? Depending on what your camera is capturing at, for me, a 16-bit Photoshop file captured with a Canon 5D is like 72 megabytes. It's a whopper. But it's also very high quality, and I can make easily a 12 by 16 print with it. So that's the good news. But let's say that I want to put that on a web page, or I want to send it as an email or something. Obviously, you're not going to send your Aunt Mary a 72 megabyte Photoshop file, because she probably won't open it, won't know how to open it, might not even be able to download it if she's on dial-up. So we don't want to put her through any of that. So you sort of have this intermediate master file, right? Your original master file is the raw file itself, which you have tucked away on your hard drive, and hopefully you're going to back it up real soon and have it archived somewhere. Then you sort of have this working master, which is the raw file that's been converted to a Photoshop file that has some basic image adjustments, and that's sort of like your working master. And you can open that and play with it all you want, and you don't have to worry about destruction of image quality, because it's a non-destructive format. But it's too big for a lot of practical things, such as web pages and emailing and so forth. So now what you're going to do is you're going to sample it down again and save it as a JPEG. This is where JPEG really shines, because it's a very portable format, and it's also compresses much better. Now, a JPEG is 8-bit, so if you did stay in 16-bits through up until this point, and if that's what your master Photoshop file is, then you do have to sample that down to 8-bits, and you can do that in Photoshop if you go up, I believe, to the mode menu, and just, it'll be listed as 16-bits, and just change it to 8-bits, and it takes like 1 second to do that. And then you might want to also sample it down, make it just a smaller size, the dimensions of it. A lot of times when you share photos with people, they only need to be 640 by 480 or 500 by 300, whatever. So you might want to sample it down to using image size in Photoshop or whatever that command is in your application. And then finally save it as a JPEG. And I do like to save at pretty high quality setting. Generally speaking, you have a choice between 1 through 12, 12 being the highest quality and the largest file, 1 being the least amount of quality and the smallest file. I like to stay around 10. So save it around 10, and that doesn't apply as much compression and leaves you with a pretty good looking image. Okay, so now you actually have three versions of the same shot. You have the original RAW file that you have to store and catalog somewhere. You have your working master, which is a Photoshop or TIFF file. And then you have your portable, your working file, your sharing file. And that's a JPEG, and that's usually a lot smaller size and less resolution. Okay, and that you can ship around. Now here's one tip that I have, and I have debates with people about this in the workshop, but I feel pretty strongly about it. That original file that you captured has an image number in the file name. For Canon, it's like IMG underscore 4572 dot, you know, CR2, all right, or whatever. And all the different camera manufacturers have their own naming conventions. What I like to do is I like to hang on to that image number that's assigned to it. I'll change the IMG to something else. Thule Elk 4572, okay, or, you know, Blue Heron 4572, whatever that happens to be. But I like to keep that image number always in the file name, because what it does is it helps me match up that original raw file that I have with the Photoshop master negative with the working sharing JPEG. If I have that number consistent through all three of those versions of it, then when I have to find one particular version or another, it's a lot easier to do, because I can always do a search on that file number. That means also that when you're shooting pictures, you need to have your camera set so that it's always building the file numbers and it's not resetting them every time you erase the image card, so that it's always creating unique file numbers. And that way you'll be able to have a unique file name to search on as you're looking for stuff. And let's say that you have the JPEG of the Blue Heron shot, but you really want to go back and rework it and make an 11 by 14 print. So you want to find either that master Photoshop file or that that original raw file. If you have that number in the JPEG, 4572, then you can search on that through your computer hard drive or through the external hard drives that you store stuff on, and find those original files easily and quickly, and then that way get back to work. So that's something that I think is pretty important. You know, we all have our own ways of filing and retrieving things. Really, whatever works for you is good, but make sure you have some sort of plan, or you'll drive yourself crazy looking for stuff that you shot even a few months ago. Okay, so this is sort of the workflow of piecing together different software. In the case of the stuff that I shot this week, I'm using the software that came with the camera to browse the thumbnails, to figure out which shots I like, to look at the metadata, and to decide which ones I want to work on more. Once I make that decision, then I'm opening them in Camera Raw, and I'm making the final adjustments and saving them as Photoshop files, and also making a copy of them as JPEGs to share with other people, or like via the web or by email. And then I'm storing all this stuff to the best of my ability, not only on the hard drive on my computer, but also at least one other external hard drive. And if you want, you can burn it on the DVD too. Now, when Aperture comes out, which will be here in another month or so, and after I have a chance to use it, I'll talk about that, and we can compare how that workflow is better, hopefully, or not better, than this piecemeal workflow that we have right now. But I hope within this conversation, you have a little better idea of what it takes to work with these raw files. I hope that it doesn't discourage you from using them when it's the appropriate file format, which is in tricky lighting conditions, or when you just want to milk the most quality that you can from your image sensor. At the same time, you should realize that you need to have set aside a little extra time in post-processing these files, because they do take a little bit more work. All right, we'll be talking a lot more about this in the future. I think next week, though, I'm going to go on to a different subject. For those of you that aren't interested in raw files, you've sat through two podcasts now, and next week I'll go on to something else. We'll come back to this, though, up the road. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you next week. This is Derek Story with thedigitalstory.com. Make sure you go to the show notes. I'll have more information for you there, and I look forward to seeing you next week. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Your questions and comments, email them to questions@thedigitalstory.com.
For show notes, web blogs, and informative articles, visit www.thedigitalstory.com. We'll see you next time on The Digital Story.